The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
What inspired Chang Rae Lee's new novel, his first since 2014? Lee will be here to discuss his latest book, My Year Abroad. Is the death penalty on the wane in America? Maurice Chamas will be here to talk about his book, Let the Lord Sort Them. Liz Harris will have an update from the publishing world. Plus, my colleagues and I will talk about what we're reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's February 5th. I'm Pamela Paul. Chang Rae Lee joins us now. His new novel is called My Year Abroad. Chang, thanks for being here.
Hi, Pamela.
So you are joining us from Hawaii, which leads to an obvious question. What are you doing in Hawaii other than carrying out perhaps every quarantined person who's not in Hawaii's sort of quarantine fantasy?
Well, there are plenty of those people here, those expats. Well, we try to come every year. Didn't come last year because long ago I was the writer in residence at the Punahou School, Barack Obama's old school, and a lot of other famous folks, and we had a wonderful year, and friends on the faculty, and so we miss seeing them. So we do the usual things, eat a lot of Asian food. I like to bodyboard.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think now any author or aspiring author is like putting this on their list of aspirations now too, like to be the writer in residence at Obama's old school. So My Year Abroad is your first novel since On Such a Full Sea, which came out in 2014. Did you start this book immediately after On Such a Full Sea? Do you tend to start your novels before the new one comes out? I'm curious how you kind of work that.
Well, I started it probably about 9 months afterwards. I tend to need a waiting period, as it were, before I start something in earnest, because I don't write short fiction. Sometimes I write short non-fictional essays about me and my family, but with a novel, the commitment is so great, and I know the road ahead will be difficult. So it's really hard for me to get to committing to a book. I'll sketch, you know, 3 or 4 different versions of a book. Sometimes they're different books for the first 6 to 9 months, sort of a thing I'm doing right now. And then finally, I'll land on one and decide, yes, this is the one that I think I can sustain and that maybe can sustain me.
Well, I was going to ask, what is your starting point with a new novel? But maybe I'll change it to, what are your starting points? Like, is it theme? Is it character? Is it a premise or a challenge to yourself as a writer?
It's actually a diverse range of things. Sometimes it's a character. And right now I'm working on like maybe 3 or 4 things. Sometimes it's a premise. I like this idea about a summer camp that I went to that was for Korean kids only, Korean Christian kids. And then sometimes it's a tone. A lot of times I've felt as if starting a new novel, that's kind of a reaction, a response to what I'd been doing before. And so I just want a change of mood, a change of a certain kind of sound. And maybe that's something that has followed me throughout my work, especially at the inception stage, is a certain kind of sound overtakes me. And either that's a personal voice for the character or the narrative voice, or even just the kind of atmosphere or mood of the piece, of what I think the world of the novel will be. And then I'll just toy around with that for a while.
I want to talk about that certain kind of sound and also the reaction to On Such a Full Sea, but I have to pause and ask you about that camp. What was that camp? Was that in the U.S.?
It was. I grew up in New York, in the city, and then in the suburbs. So it was a camp that was run by an association of Korean churches in the tri-state area. So for 2 weeks every summer, from the time I was 5 years old to, I think it was probably 14, maybe 13, 14, it definitely didn't go past there because they didn't want real teens at the camp because they didn't want to invite a different set of problems.
I was going to say, to corrupt the youth.
Right. Because it was a church-based camp. So they all got together and I guess rented a camp for 2 weeks, you know, north of Westchester, I think Putnam County somewhere. I can't even remember where it was, maybe near Brewster. And so for 2 weeks, this place, and it was a very low-end camp, you know, there were no jet skis, there were no horses, there was hardly any fields. Basically, there was, I think, a volleyball net and just kind of a high grass and you know, really spare, unheated cabins with barely running water. But I tell you, it was some of the best times I've ever had. Also, you know, as camps go, they introduce you to all the problems of the world, but on a scale that, you know, that kids can understand, you know, jealousy, corruption, you know, just all the kinds of things that go on. But the funny thing about it was my time for 2 weeks to be with only Korean kids, Korean American kids.
Was that why your parents sent you? Like, did they want to kind of help you reinforce and affirm your identity as a Korean American?
I think that was their hope. And they weren't religious people. So even though there was a Bible study element to the camp, that was the part that we all didn't want to go to and kind of, you know, slacked on. But yeah, I think they were absolutely hoping that I would connect with other Korean kids, not speak the language, because none of us really spoke Korean. Because many of us didn't come from an ethnic enclave, say, like in Queens or something. And so as I did in Westchester, did not grow up with any other Korean kids at all. So it was our time.
We'll read about this summer camp, I hope, in your next novel. Hopefully it'll be one of the threads that you're currently working on that wins out, because I find that fascinating. But to get to the new novel, My Year Abroad, tell us a little bit about it. And then I want to talk about in what ways it was kind of a reaction to On Such a Full Sea.
Well, it's a kind of a crazy book, and particularly, I think, for people who know my work, it was sort of a surprise. You know, I'm sure my editor was surprised by what she got. I didn't quite describe it the way it turned out. But it's a book about a 20-year-old college kid who's at loose ends in every way in his life, not very moored in his comfortable but drab suburban existence, and he meets up with a local entrepreneur, a Chinese fellow, who's not quite Chinese-American. He's really just Chinese, but has made a big-time life in the suburb in New Jersey and has businesses all over the world. And this young man named Tiller gets taken up by him, and they go traveling together. And I guess they have what might call business adventures, but those adventures get quite intense. I would say.
So this is the year abroad. Where do they go?
Well, they stop in Hawaii first from New Jersey. So there's a couple scenes in Hawaii. And then they pretty much end up in Asia, in China, in Shenzhen, in Macau, and then in the private retreat of a very wealthy and scary businessman named Drum Capagota in the hills of the Pearl River Valley.
You alternate the narrative between Tiller and Pong. What are the advantages and the challenges of writing in that form?
Once you start bringing in this other voice, and in this novel, it's not all the way through. It's just pockets that the Chinese businessman Pong will tell us his own story. I guess you worry that, oh, you'll break the rhythm of the narrative, given that Tiller has, you know, mastered it this whole time. That you think that he's the consciousness that's going to inform everything, and then suddenly you're confronted with this other consciousness and voice. So that's the big worry. But I, as I tell my students, and as I tried to tell myself, if you tell the story well enough, if you take us to places that we absolutely want to go to, don't worry. You can go as far and as wide as you like, as long as the reader is happy, and that you're obviously still somewhat connected to where you were before, but that narrative will eventually wind its way back. And so I kind of have faith in that. Maybe it's blind faith, maybe it's the stupidity, but I guess I believed in that.
One of the things you've said is that you like to write about people being pushed to extremes and kind of in difficult situations. What is the interest there for you?
Well, in terms of narrative, it's just sort of fun. or if it's not in a fun context, it can be dark and very kind of disturbing, which I've always been drawn to. So I've been drawn to extremity in my work. You know, in my more historical novels about war and sexual slavery, that extremity was something that I couldn't help but keep looking at and keep looking at, mostly because I always wonder what the aftermath of that extremity is psychically. We know what it is bodily, but that's for me the primary interest. And the same thing goes here. Even though the intensity, the flagrant acts, the wild stuff that happens is kind of entertaining, I hope it's entertaining. I don't think it's enjoyable, and at least for Tiller, but it's, I think, in some ways revelatory for him. And I think he needs to be shaken out of that. And that's what I think sometimes I felt like I needed, you know, just in my mental states of being, you know, pretty much in a quite a cloistered and quiet life.
I'm curious if there's some wish fulfillment in terms of place and the research that you presumably had to do on some of the places where the book takes place, some of the settings in Shenzhen and Macau. Did you go to those places? And I'm curious if part of the desire to see those places or to set scenes in those places stems from a personal desire to see what those places are like.
Well, these are places that I've been to in my life. I didn't go to these places for the purposes of the book. So it wasn't, you know, research that I did just for this book. It's just in the course of my time, you know, On Such a Full Sea has a Chinese angle to the story. And for many years, I was just interested in China and wanted to write books about China. And so maybe in some sense, this is one of those books. And part of this is perhaps one of the reasons I decided to move to the West Coast. You know, I teach at Stanford now, taught at Princeton for many years very happily. But I think I've been kind of migrating west and closer to Asia. And I like the West Coast for different reasons. But one of them is it's an Asian inflected, at least more so than, say, you know, the New York tri-state area for me. And that's something that in my imagination, I've been drawn to Asia and to actually going there myself more regularly. And I don't know if connecting to that part of me, but I don't know if I would say that, but just connecting to that wonder and the curiosity.
You brought up two things that I have wanted to ask you about. One is your teaching, but also before that, your move from Princeton to Stanford. So in my complete outside of academia way, you know, I look at the writing program at Princeton, which is one of the best in the country. And I think, who leaves that? But of course, I've spent a little time at Stanford too. And it feels like a place that I don't want to say breeds superior human beings, but it certainly attracts them and like packages them in a way that they go out into the world and rule over us all. I'm just curious if you see a difference in the interests and priorities between your writing students at Princeton and at Stanford. And they're all pretty much undergraduates, right?
At Stanford, I do have postgraduates in the famed Stegner Fellows Program, named after Wallace Stegner. And we've had so many great writers come through there that we all read now. Some of the more recent ones would be like Otessa Moshfegh.
I wasn't suggesting that Stanford was a bunch of slackers in the writing department.
but at Princeton, it was purely undergrad teaching. We didn't have a graduate program there. And yes, wonderful, wonderful students and wonderful colleagues. And I would say, you know, the Princeton students are not slackers, obviously. And as I tell people, really the students are very similar. You know, they're super motivated, incredibly bright, and talented in so many different ways. You're just surprised to hear, you know, how they're, you know, concert pianists, but also, you know, throw the javelin, you know. Do architecture on the side. But maybe being at Stanford and being in Silicon Valley, a lot of the students tend to be more STEM interested. And my undergrad students that I have there, even though they are, a lot of them have been because of a particular class I teach, Asian American or of some Asian extraction. And even if they are majoring or studying or focused on STEM things, they end up being great writers, a lot of them. So no, I mean, I don't really think that they're different at all. I just think that maybe the Stanford students seem like, oh yeah, I've developed this app, you know, that I'm about to sell to Google.
An app that will write Asian American novels better than anyone else, any human ever could.
oh, I hope not. But I wouldn't be surprised if the Princeton students were doing the exact same things, actually. They're just, you know, they're so diverse in their brilliance.
Your first novel, Native Speaker, was published in 1995. Have things changed, and in what ways, for Asian American writers since that first novel came out, from your point of view?
Well, there's just so many more of us, and which is, I think, a wonderful thing in several different ways. I mean, when Native Speaker was published, as it goes with books or pieces of art that come from a community that hasn't been represented as much, there's a lot of attention paid to that in good ways and in bad ways. Maybe too much is asked of those novels to represent or say something about, say, the Korean-American experience, which that novel does and doesn't want to do. And so now I think here we are so many years later, 25 years later, and you see the production from Asian-American and people of Asian descent and the diversity of their interests, their voices, their aesthetics, their literary modalities.
And also countries, right? I mean, it's such a broad category.
Absolutely. And also countries. So it's so much harder for the establishment to define what Asian American, and for everyone else to define what Asian American writing is, which I think is great. That's always the hope, right? That, you know, you read a writer like Susan Choi, or you read Katie Kitamura, or you read Sigrid Nunez, who's partly Asian. And there's nothing to be said about, oh, yes, they all are writing about this and this and this. No, we can't say that. They are writing brilliantly in their own way about that particular thing that they're interested in.
So that gets to a very interesting question then about your class on Asian American identity. What else is on your curriculum? Well, assuming, I don't know if you put your own novel on there, but what is on your curriculum?
It's not a class on Asian American identity. It's a class on Asian American autobiography, which is, I think, different. And I don't actually assign book length projects. I just pick essays from here and there, many from writers who are not long published, sometimes really young writers. And it's a writing class primarily, where the students are writing stories about their lives and their own psyches. It's a wonderful class for me because I get to see and hear from these students who, most of them are Asian American, some are not, because it's open to everyone. But I guess our literature study is these stories from all parts of Asian America and the Asian experience. So we have stories that focus on gender identity and focus on immigrancy, others just on philosophical questions. So again, you know, I'm looking for and looking to present a diversity of experience and consciousness to these students. And I think one of the best things that come out of the class for me is that they come into the class asking, well, I took this class so that I couldn't find out about my Asian identity. But they leave the class thinking, well, no, that's not the question I'm interested in asking. You know, I'm interested in a much wider field of what the Asian American experience is right now, and understanding and recognizing that that is constantly mutating.
All right. Well, if we don't start our listeners with reading from your curriculum, we can start with reading My Year Abroad, the new novel. Chang, thank you so much again for being here.
Thanks so much, Pamela.
My Year Abroad is the new book by Chang Ray Lee.
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihe.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with The New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Tina Jordan joins us now for a celebration of the 125th anniversary of the book review, which we will be doing all year long. Tina, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. What are we going to talk about this week?
The letters page, which is a fascinating exercise because, of course, when the book review started, at first there weren't very many letters. They came in at a trickle. The editor would even try to get people to write by saying things like, let me know what your favorite short stories are. I'll print every letter I get. It wasn't very long until the letters page, which was called Comment and Query at the outset, pretty much exploded. It started at one page, it went to two pages, sometimes it was three pages. And I kind of love that it was, you know, the message board of its day.
One of the things I love about the book review is that we're one of the few sections at the Times that has its own letters page to begin with, right? It's just us and the magazine, and everything else is on the main letters page of the New York Times.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And at the beginning, people weren't even really writing in to talk about reviews. They wrote in to ask for book recommendations. And the interesting thing was, they weren't just asking the editors of the book review. They were asking other readers of the book review. So if somebody wrote in and said, give me a list of books for my 18-year-old daughter, the first reply the first week would just be from the editor of the book review. But then for weeks, people would write in with recommendations.
We were like book Twitter.
It was like book Twitter. Exactly. When people disagreed about reviews, the book review would print the letters for months. Sister Carrie was one of the first novels that inspired a lot of mail, but the one I love was The House of Mirth by Edith Wharton, which drove people to write letters for 6 months.
Wow. Why?
Because it was a polarizing novel. You know, New York society didn't like the way it was portrayed in the novel. I was going to read you just a snippet or two from letters we got back then because I enjoyed them so much. So here's one of the first letters. I just finished The House of Mirth and hope to soon forget it. I think the whole story produces a bad taste in the mouth, points to no moral, and as to the title, it should be changed to The House of Lies.
Tina, can I write this person back?
Yeah, right. So that's signed Newport. Then somebody writes in the next week. This is an answer to the reader who signs herself Newport. As a strong adherent of Mrs. Wharton and her literary style, I take up the cudgels on behalf of the large majority who voice my sentiments. We prefer the extravagant praises of an army of reviewers to the harsh, badly expressed, and uncalled for remarks of one unsympathetic critic. So then the next week, somebody who's had it with both of those people writes in and says, these here letters signed Lennox and Newport give me a pain, and goes on and on in that vein, and says, the only criticism I can make of the book is that she would have been fairer to the smart set if she had run in a few purer, high-minded, cultured representatives like me, who are doing our best to discourage bridge and make the ladies stop smoking cigarettes.
All right, I want to bring back a couple of catchphrases of that era. I want to bring back the smart set and also give me a pain. Those are good.
Also cudgels.
Yes,
you
cudgels.
Know, really, cudgels.
A really good word. Okay, Tina, we're going to have to return to this subject again.
We need to hear
more letters.
Absolutely.
All right, Tina Jordan, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Maurice Chamat joins us now from Austin, Texas. His new book is called Let the Lord Sort Them, The Rise and Fall of the Death Penalty. Maurice, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You write on this subject for The Marshall Project. I don't know if all our listeners are familiar with this nonprofit journalistic enterprise, so tell us a little bit about the Marshall Project and the work that you do there and how this book rose from your reporting.
I've been at the Marshall Project for the last 6 years. I started working there before it technically existed. We launched a few months after I joined. And the Marshall Project is a, I sometimes say small, though we're growing, a nonprofit news outlet that covers the criminal justice system. The mission statement is about creating a sense of national urgency around criminal justice. We're kind of founded in the wake of the protests that were happening in Ferguson and Baltimore 6 years ago. And we do mostly investigative reporting, but also explanatory stories and sort of magazine-y style features on everything from, you know, jails and prisons to policing to how the court system works, you know, stories on prosecutors and defense lawyers and police. So when I came to the Marshall Project, I had been freelancing in Texas, mostly writing criminal justice stories and doing a lot of death penalty stories. They tended to be about individual cases. Sometimes I would sort of zoom out and look at bigger themes. But at the Marshall Project, my editors there really encouraged me to kind of think broadly and try to tie lots of different cases together. And so the first story that I worked on there was about an angle that had just popped up in a different area of reporting. And one of my editors said, let's go deep on that. And it was the cost of the death penalty. It was finding out that an individual death sentence could cost $1 million or more, and even more than that, kind of break the bank in a small county and just be sort of the equivalent of a flood or a tornado that just comes and, you know, wrecks the municipal budget. So I went deep on that, rounded up a bunch of cases from the country and did that story. And around that time, I was starting to kind of form the proposal for this book and think similarly about how to tie lots of cases together around these sort of broad themes that have defined the rise and fall of the death penalty.
Let's stop there for a moment, because I think the obvious question is, why does it cost that much? I mean, one kind of brutal argument in favor, or at least it sounds brutal, maybe to me, in favor of the death penalty is people say, like, well, it costs so much money to keep someone in prison for life. Like, why not just kill them? As a kind of an argument that it's efficient and expedient to do so. Sounds like that is false.
Yes. And it surprised me. I mean, I had the same assumption that you did when I started reporting on it. And then, you know, prosecutors admitted to me that they couldn't afford it. And I looked into why is that. It's because over the course of the last 30 years, the Supreme Court has raised the bar for the level of kind of care that lawyers need to take on these cases. There's more investigation that they have to do. There's a culture around hiring really good experts to assess, you know, does this person have a brain injury or a serious mental illness or an intellectual disability? And those experts sort of the time that they take on these cases really racks up the dollars. And then once the person is sentenced to death, they go to death row, and where if they went to a normal prison, there might be a yearly cost of housing them in prison. That is dwarfed by the cost of paying for their appeals and paying for the court system to handle their appeals. And, you know, many times over the last 20, 30 years, politicians have said, well, let's solve that problem by reducing the amount of appeals that they're allowed to, kind of curtailing the sort of legal representation that they're entitled to. But what ends up happening when you cut away at the meat there, you start hitting bone and you start having cases where innocent people are, you know, more likely to get executed. People who have sort of gross constitutional violations in their trials just sort of speed towards execution without anyone sort of representing them fully and separating, you know, the cases of what meets the Constitution's needs versus ones that violate it. So it's a super complex picture, but just over time, all of these different legal dynamics have kind of inched up the cost to the point where it can be hundreds of thousands, if not $1 million, to sentence someone to death. And the final point to make about that is that it falls hardest on tiny counties. I tell a story in the book about the case in Jasper, Texas, that made sort of international news of a Black man who was effectively lynched by three white supremacists. And there was a call for those men to get the death penalty. And three death penalty trials was the tax burden of one tiny town in East Texas, and they had to raise taxes several percent. They had to put off other projects that they wanted to do as a town. So there are these dynamics that play out where you realize the death penalty isn't just a criminal justice question. It kind of touches all these other areas of public policy.
You started off reporting, as you said, about individual cases, and it's natural, I think, for when we talk about the death penalty to immediately home in on a case that either seems, and depending on where you fall opinion-wise on the death penalty, incredibly egregious or incredibly justified. It also seems like death penalty is one of those issues that people kind of seem to forget about in this country until some significant story raises awareness, whether it's someone like Sister Helen Prejean or Brian Stevenson kind of advocating. Why isn't the death penalty more a topic of debate and discussion in this country, do you think? And I can't recall the last time the death penalty was really raised in a major election. I mean, you mentioned George W. Bush when he was governor, but certainly not presidential election. Why isn't the death penalty more a topic of discussion and debate in this country?
It's a really good question. And part of the answer is that it used to be. One of the fascinating parts of researching this book was revisiting a time that I kind of dimly remembered when the death penalty had a role in the sort of culture war pantheon, along with gun control and with abortion. I interviewed one longtime Texas legislator, and he told me that in the 1990s, every time he would meet someone just who didn't know much about him, but knew he was a politician and was kind of starstruck meeting an elected official and didn't know what to say, their go-to question was, do you believe in the death penalty? It was this sort of catch-all political idea that you were tough. And there were times in the late 80s, early 90s when it would come up. People remember maybe the Willie Horton ad in 1988, but separately in that presidential election, Michael Dukakis was asked about the death penalty, and he said that he was opposed to it, and it was really bad for him electorally. We reach in the mid to late 90s a kind of peak of the death penalty where there's lots and lots of executions. George Bush runs for president, and he has at that point overseen dozens and dozens of executions in Texas. And it's kind of an exotic quirk of his state that everyone looks at really closely. There are cases at that time like Carla Faye Tucker and Gary Graham where hundreds of people show up outside the prison in Huntsville protesting on either side of the issue. But starting around the year 2000, it feels like that was a kind of high watermark where something broke. And over the 20 years since, the death penalty has declined both in the number of people who support it, but I think more importantly, specifically to your question, in relevance. It's less of a thing that people feel matters to their daily lives. And I think there's a few reasons. One is that crime went down, you know, that the amount of just violent crime in America went into decline. And despite what President Trump said on the campaign trail, it's at generational lows now. And so I think people are a little less worried about being the victims of crime and a little less sort of casting about for solutions, of which the death penalty tends to be touted as one. Another theory that I find really interesting that a defense lawyer told me, even it's just speculation because this is almost like an anthropological question about our culture, but that after 9/11, a sense of kind of who to be scared of or who the enemy was in American life shifted away from violent crime and serial killers and the idea of just a murderer to terrorism and the idea that the
enemy without as opposed to the enemy within.
That's right. That's right. And I think all of these things sort of culturally pushed the death penalty sort of out of the limelight and made it a kind of quieter thing that was just continuing to happen, but only if you were really paying attention.
But pulling back for a second, which countries other than America right now allow for capital punishment?
Europe has abandoned capital punishment, as has Canada. And the countries that are left that use capital punishment regularly, you know, overwhelmingly tend to be non-democracies, you know, China, Iran, Saudi Arabia. An interesting data point of a country that is a democracy and still has the death penalty is Japan. So it's not sort of exclusively non-democracies, but it does tend to put the United States in a section of the world that we don't normally like to think of ourselves as being in.
And yet, as you pointed out earlier, it's very much part of the culture. Can you talk a little bit about the origins of the death penalty in America? I mean, presumably it came over at the time from British law.
Since the founding of the United States, there had been executions, a death penalty, a lot of hangings. And it was something that we inherited from England. And then over the course of the early 20th century, we had shifted from hangings to electric chair executions that were behind closed doors. It's worth also mentioning in this context that throughout the Jim Crow South, there were, you know, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of illegal mob lynchings of primarily Black men. And while those were not legal executions, often the line could be very blurry. So that's another kind of cultural inheritance that we have that other countries don't. So you fast forward to the 1960s, Europe, a lot of countries around the world are getting rid of the death penalty. They're seeing it sort of post-World War II as a violation of human rights that they feel sort of more queasy about in the wake of the Nazi regime falling, the Vietnam War. The idea that governments are exercising powers of life and death becomes a little bit more uncomfortable for a lot of people, at least in sort of Western democracies. I should say that when I started researching this book, I kind of dimly knew it, but it was fascinating to learn about this period in the 1960s where America also joined these countries and essentially got rid of the death penalty. There were still people on death row, but executions basically halted, and there was a sense that maybe we too were on the cusp of doing away with it.
That's one of the reasons why I found the subtitle of your book so interesting, The Rise and Fall of the Death Penalty, because it does seem a little bit like the rise and fall and the rise again and maybe the fall again of the death penalty.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, I say in the introduction that, you know, we've always been as a country a bit ambivalent. And as a result, we have a kind of chaotic history. I mean, really, if you zoom out, it's chaos in the sense that, you know, Michigan, the state, abolished the death penalty in the 1850s. Many other states have not had a death penalty in equally as long. And then you have states like, you know, Texas and Florida that are continuing to carry it out today. But the rise and fall describes the kind of predominant arc of the last 40 years. I mean, if you look at just the graphs, the death penalty nearly disappeared in the 1960s. And then in 1972, the Supreme Court made a kind of landmark ruling against it. And there was a tremendous backlash to that ruling. It, in some ways, seemed like yet another civil rights dictate from Washington that Southern states could push back against as their part of their view on states' rights. And all these states go and they write new death penalty laws. The whole machinery grinds back into motion. And it has this rise through the 80s and 90s, and then it has a fall starting in the year 2000, leading to the present day. And there's a, not an irony, but a quirk of the book's release is that, you know, when I wrote it, I had no idea that President Trump was going to carry out, you know, more than a dozen federal executions. And that has, I think, made a lot of people say, wait a minute, this book says the fall of the death penalty, but I feel like I just heard about all these cases in the news. And it's true that Trump carried them out, but the number of executions every year is still falling. Even with those Trump executions, it's lower than it's ever been, and it's continuing to go down. And even more dramatically, executions rise and fall here and there, but the beginning of the whole legal process is that you have to get a death sentence in a trial. And the number of new death sentences in trials across the country is also shrinking to kind of generational lows. So there's arguments about what the future holds, and none of us can predict it. But I personally come to the feeling that we've hit the end of the fall, and to really revive the death penalty and embrace it again as a country, it would take some big other cultural shifts that are sort of impossible for us to predict.
I think one of the things that's confusing to people is that 1972 Supreme Court decision, because people thought, oh, there's no more death penalty after that. But as you said, in the aftermath, states began to create their own laws around the death penalty. So what was that decision exactly? And was the argument against capital punishment legal, moral, practical? Was it about flaws in execution? What was the basis of that decision?
So that decision was called Furman versus Georgia, and it came out in 1972. And the arguments that had been made against executions were primarily made by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, you know, which many people associate with Thurgood Marshall before he went to the Supreme Court. And this group of lawyers are based in New York City. They were very much motivated by the morality and the concerns about racial inequality. They felt that the death penalty was very connected to lynchings and that Black men primarily were disproportionately sentenced to death, particularly in the South, in the states of the former Confederacy. But at the Supreme Court, the racial elements get kind of pulled out of the conversation, and it's more of a legal question of whether the Eighth Amendment, you know, which bans cruel and unusual punishment, can allow a punishment where there's very little meaning to who gets the death sentence and who doesn't. That two people could essentially commit the exact same crime, and one gets the death penalty and one doesn't. And there's no logic. So one member of the Supreme Court at the time very famously wrote that being sentenced to death was being struck by lightning. You know, that you could commit the same murder and get the death sentence or not get the death sentence, and the outcomes are completely random. And they threw out the death penalty on that basis, which meant that because it wasn't a moral argument, it was an argument just about sort of separating the wheat from the chaff in the legal system. And that invited states that wanted to keep the death penalty to go back and rewrite their laws. So states around the country got to work. They worked very quickly. They all felt a lot of electoral pressure because, as I said before, there was this tremendous societal backlash. Public polling found that the support for the death penalty was on the decline, and it took the Supreme Court decision to kind of reverse that trend. And people almost, in a sense, didn't realize how much they liked the death penalty until they were deprived of it. And they start pressuring their legislators to rewrite the laws. And then across the country, you know, many states, certainly not all of them, but, you know, about 30 states go and write new laws. Texas writes a kind of very quirky and particular law that is in some ways harsher than a lot of other laws that are allowed to pass through. It's kind of the harshest of the laws that the Supreme Court goes on to accept. And that kind of paves the way for the state being so identified with the death penalty later on. You know, it's been responsible for something like a third of executions in the last 40 years.
It's kind of analogous with Roe v. Wade, the decision from around that same time, that it isn't really until a Supreme Court decision comes down that it really galvanizes the opposition and makes something that wasn't necessarily at the forefront of national political divides become huge.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It is a lot like Roe v. Wade, and it is a lesson in the way that sort of Supreme Court decisions have these unintended cultural backlashes that one can't really predict. You know, in fact, Sarah Weddington, who argued Roe v. Wade, was one of the Texas legislators who was tasked with deciding how to write a new death penalty law in 1973. All these things were coming around the same time. I also think it's worth saying that the backlash, I think, works in the other direction, too. And now what we're seeing is that, in a way, these Trump executions, by kind of bringing the death penalty to the front of the public agenda and injecting it with a lot of partisanship again, Donald Trump has kind of galvanized opponents of the death penalty and given them a lot more strength than I think they would have had. And it's almost a reversal of what happened in 1972.
Listeners of this podcast know that I recently read and talked about Bryan Stevenson's book, Just Mercy. How effective are organizations like his, the Innocent Project, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, in terms of getting some of these death row decisions overturned?
One fascinating part of the research for this book was revisiting the sort of prehistory of Bryan Stevenson and the sorts of organizations that he works with. Bryan, in the early 90s, worked for a little legal firm that was set up with federal money that was basically a group of defense lawyers who were working to defend people on death row. I studied very closely the analogous Texas organization, and some of those lawyers, when I asked them their motivations for getting into this work of defending people on death row, a couple of them actually said that in the early 90s, they heard Bryan Stevenson himself give lectures at their law school. And they were inspired by his sense of mission. And so it was fascinating to me to imagine that Bryan Stevenson, he sort of emerged in the public eye a few years ago for most of us, but for this world of defense lawyers who oppose the death penalty, he had long been a kind of leading light. And in the early 90s, these defense lawyers were under tremendous pressure. There were hundreds of people on death row. There were not enough lawyers. They were kind of reviled in the public eye as these zealots who want to defend the worst of the worst and get them off, you know, death row on technicalities. And there was had a real kind of bunker mentality that set in around that work. But over time, they just kind of did the work little by little. Their organizations, having previously had federal money, they lost that funding in 95, 96 and disbanded and then reformed themselves. And one version of their reforming was the Equal Justice Initiative, where Bryan Stevenson, you know, now is the director. There were analogous organizations in Texas and North Carolina and Florida, across the South. And these organizations became the dominant fighters against the death penalty, and it took a very long time for their efforts to bear fruit. You know, they would win a case here and there. They would convince the courts that somebody was potentially innocent and get their conviction overturned. These lawyers would, you know, occasionally quietly win at the Supreme Court and find that the issue would actually affect 10 or 20 or even 40 cases at a time. And so they had victories over those years, even as the death penalty was tremendously popular and very much in motion in the U.S. And then, you know, we get closer to the present day and the discussion around racial justice and inequality really comes to the fore in American life. And these lawyers have kind of been doing this for 20, 30 years and have a real deep understanding of how the legal system produces these unequal outcomes. And we then kind of come to them as the leading lights to sort of guide us forward.
Have you witnessed an execution?
I have not. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice, which carries out executions here, has very kind of particular bureaucratic rules around who can witness them. And I was just never allowed, basically, based on these rules. And when I started working on the book about 5 years ago, I thought, well, you know, I should really do my best to work around these rules and try to get in, just because I think I could describe it more richly. And I told this plan to a man named Walter Long, who has been a kind of less of a source than more of a just mentor. He's a longtime defense lawyer who understands the system in a very deep and humane way. And he said, you know, no, don't do it. I highly advise against that. You know, your whole project is to sort of explain the traumas that people face and maybe even help decrease the amount of just sort of trauma in the world. And so putting yourself through that is kind of not worth it. If you have any choice at all, just don't do it.
That's interesting that he describes that as your project, because you're also a journalist reporting on this.
You know, sometimes when you report on these really difficult things and put yourself in there, the lines get very difficult. I mean, I read an amazing Q&A with Luke Mogelson about war reporting a couple of weeks ago, and he writes very beautifully about the kind of ethical questions as a reporter when you're putting yourself very close to these really horrific things, like how much at a certain point are you playing a role in them? And as a reporter, you know, you can try to maintain a sense of distance. And I think that I overall as a reporter do that, but you can't expose yourself to other people's trauma through interviews over and over and over again without a certain amount of that infecting you. And I have certainly found times where I was kind of emotionally overwhelmed by hearing about an execution date. And so I think it would have been impossible to witness an execution without being somewhat traumatized by it.
Given the emotional impact on you of witnessing and reporting on all of this trauma, was your founding of the Insider Prize part of your way of coping with that? Tell us a little bit about that contest.
So the Insider Prize is a writing contest for incarcerated people who write fiction and also nonfiction essays. And it's organized, there's a small literary journal in Austin, Texas, where I live, called American Short Fiction. And my wife and I took on this project, which was hatched by a creative writing professor and novelist at the University of Texas named Debbil and Unferth. It was sort of her idea because she had a group of prisoners in a Texas prison that she was teaching writing to, and they were all submitting to a similar contest that PEN America puts on, but they wanted sort of more opportunities to submit their work and get recognized. And one aspect of reporting that I find sort of very emotionally troubling and difficult is that I do a lot of correspondence with incarcerated people in prison who are constantly writing to me, often as sources for stories that I'm working on. But then inevitably they're telling me about, you know, their kids or their life or how they spent their day inside. And I do my best to respond to them and sort of open up these relationships. But I did feel a kind of emotional burden of just all of these letters coming in and feeling like, you know, I could never do enough to kind of be there for these people who seem to kind of need so much because they're so cut off from the world. And when the Insider Prize was pitched to us, I was kind of excited by it because it felt like a way that I could give back in elevating the voices of these people behind bars and also helping the public see that they're more than the crimes that they committed to get there. And we, you know, the crimes are sort of disconnected and an afterthought in this context. You know, we sometimes don't even know what people have done. They sort of just submit their fiction and essays sort of as if to say, we have these other parts of ourselves that we want to kind of celebrate and put out into the world. And so there is something very kind of gratifying and even a little healing about getting to read this creative work that they put together and then, you know, get really, you know, prominent guest judges like Joyce Carol Oates or Lydia Davis or Justin Torres come in and help us elevate these voices so that it kind of injects into the public conversation a richer sense of who it actually is that's in the prison system.
Well, you do that as well in this book. Maurice, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Maurice Chamas' book is Let the Lord Sort Them, The Rise and Fall of the Death Penalty. Elizabeth Harris joins us now for some news from the publishing world. Hey, Liz.
Hi, Pamela. This week, we wrote a story about a biography of Christopher Hitchens that's being written. Hitchens was an author and a speaker who was probably one of the most well-known journalists of his generation. He had this big persona, and he took these very controversial stances on things like atheism and the war in Iraq. And he died about 9 years ago. And a journalist named Stephen Phillips is writing a biography about him for the publisher W.W. Norton. But Hitchens' widow, Carol Blue Hitchens, and his former literary agent, a guy named Steve Wasserman, have been discouraging friends, family, and colleagues from participating in the biography. And they've sent around an email about it. We are aware that a self-appointed would-be biographer when Stephen Phillips is embarked on a book on Christopher. We read his proposal and are dismayed by the coarse and reductive approach. We have no confidence in this attempt at the man in full. We are not cooperating, and we urge you to refuse all entreaties by Mr. Phillips or his publisher, W.W. Norton.
This isn't completely uncommon, right, with biography. I mean, there's often the case where an estate or the loved ones, family members of the deceased don't want to cooperate with a biographer.
You can understand the inclination, right? I mean, this biographer, this total stranger is poking around the life of your loved one is totally natural to feel protected. But usually I'm told sort of the resistance is more like, you know, maybe they themselves don't want to talk, or maybe they make a few discreet phone calls, or they don't allow the biographer to like reprint long passages from articles or books that the subject has written. But it's unusual, I'm told, to send out an email, and this was circulated pretty widely, trying to get others to not cooperate either.
Give us some examples, because, you know, I know that it can be minor stuff, like not giving people the rights to excerpt passages or the rights to any photographs, but there have been some pretty wild tales. What are some of them?
Totally. So this woman, Kitty Kelly, who's a biographer, she's written about people like Oprah and the Bush family and the British royal family. When she started writing a book about Frank Sinatra in the early 80s, he sued her to try and get her to stop, which didn't work. And, you know, many, many lawyers. And about a year later, he dropped the suit. A guy named Kai Bird, who's a biographer who's won a Pulitzer for his work, told me that the subject of his very first book was a big Wall Street lawyer named John McCloy. Wrote a letter to the editor in the New York Times Book Review telling people they shouldn't talk to him for the project. This was in response to an author query that Kai Bird wrote saying in the Book Review, like, hi, I'm an author and I'm writing this book, please talk to me. And so McCloy wrote back very publicly, no, no, please don't talk to him. And then when that didn't work, McCloy took Kai Bird's editor out to lunch and tried to convince her to drop the project. And it's like, I can write my own memoir. You don't need this man. That also didn't work. And as just a little aside, that editor was Alice Mayhew, who went on to have this incredible career at Simon & Schuster. And she edited Walter Isaacson's Steve Jobs books on All the President's Men. She edited Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Jimmy Carter and also Kitty Kelly.
All right. So what is the outcome here for this biography, the Hitchens biography? I mean, is it going to proceed?
It is. Stephen Phillips told me, you know, he's conducted a lot of interviews and he's just going to kind of keep on keeping on. He's just sending out more queries and just trying to talk to as many people as possible. A lot of biographers I spoke to for this article also mentioned to me that, as we've discussed, this happens and you just are persistent. Some people will come around eventually. Kitty Kelly mentioned that even the inner circle often comes around if you are persistent enough. And, you know, if you're kind of display to them that you're doing the work, then sometimes they'll change their mind and maybe they won't, but enough people will talk to him that a book will be written regardless. It just might not include, you know, a fair number of the inner circle, which Phillips made a point that that does create sort of a reporting challenge for him in that the people who might be the most likely to respect the wishes of his widow and his former agent and not speak to Phillips are maybe people with very nice things to say. And so you end up with people who are a bit more of a remove, right, who might be a bit more ambivalent about the guy or have negative things to say. And he said he's trying, making a very deliberate effort to sort of not let the project skew negative in that way and to make sure he gets sort of all sides and, you know, all the folks or as many folks as possible who thought very highly of him as well.
I would have thought that the biggest challenge in writing a Christopher Hitchens biography is matching the wit and skill and, you know, brio of Christopher Hitchens, whether you agreed with him or not. He was always great to read. So I feel like that is challenge enough.
Oh, intimidating, right? I mean, how do you do that? But maybe if you can't quote him, then maybe it's easier.
Right. All right. Well, I'll read it. Liz, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you. joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues Tina Jordan and John Williams. Hello.
Hey, Pamela.
John, let's start with you. What are you reading?
I've been reading a ton this month, so I'm saving a couple of things for later sort of individual books that I'm going to recommend. But I'm here from the Department of the Obvious this week to talk about John Le Carré and to talk about something, Pamela, you and I haven't talked about in a long time, but we love talking about, which is the obituary read, as we call it. But this is a subset of that. Normally, what we mean when we say that is that we sort of learn about or learn a lot more about an author through an obituary, and then we're drawn to their work. This is one of those cases where Le Carré, who died in December at 89, obviously, I didn't need to learn anything really about him. I had long thought that I should read him, but, you know, spy novels, it's one of those things where you tell yourself it's not your kind of thing, and so you miss out on this amazing body of work. So I'm kind of tearing through his books. I started with the first two in the George Smiley series, which some people tell you not to because they're kind of straightforward mysteries. They feature Smiley, but not really in his spy work. It's more like in his everyday life, he's enlisted to solve a couple of things that happen. Those are called Call for the Dead and A Murder of Quality. And I really enjoyed them. They're very well written. And if you like straightforward mysteries, they're a very high level of that. But now I'm kind of into the classic Smiley books, which I finished The Spy Who Came In from the Cold recently, which is absolutely brilliant. And now I'm into Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which is fairly considerably longer than The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. But I'm making my way because they're highly readable, obviously, but I don't think I understood quite how psychologically brilliant he was in a way that make them, you know, the spy stuff is really interesting, but that's still not totally my thing. And it doesn't have to be at all to enjoy these books because he's just great on human nature and painting these portraits of people in very classically literary ways.
Okay. Have you seen both the adaptations, the TV version with Alec Guinness and the movie version with Gary Oldman?
I haven't. And actually, one of the funny reasons that this shouldn't have anything to do with the books, but a few years ago, probably 10 years ago, because time means nothing anymore, I started watching the Alec Guinness, and I'm sure that it was because it was late at night and I was tired or something, but I just, about 15 minutes in, it wasn't gripping me at all. And I love Alec Guinness. I sort of worship Alec Guinness. And so I stopped watching. And maybe that set me against the books, but I'm sure both are worth going back and watching now, right?
They are worth going back, especially, I imagine, after you read the book. And then I want you to report back on this podcast.
Guinness is not, it's not like he's George Clooney or something, but he's a movie star. And so you think of him as cool in some way. And Smiley in the books is described as, I think, literally a toad at one point early on, this sort of short, dumpy, wearing ill-fitting clothes. And it's a great description, but it doesn't exactly bring Alec Guinness immediately to mind.
I do want to also have a future Alec Guinness podcast, if we can do that at some point between talking about all the books.
Oh, God, I would love that.
And
I'll also just, since I started by talking about the obituary read, I'll just quickly at the end remind listeners and readers that our Sarah Lyle wrote a fantastic obituary of Le Carré when he died in December, which is worth going back and visiting. And our critic Dwight Garner wrote a really lovely appraisal of his work as well. Tina, what are you reading these days?
So I want to preface what I'm reading, which is Read Me by Leo Benedictus, by saying I'm really starting to notice the kinds of books that I'm reading changing all of a sudden. And by that, I mean, at the start of the pandemic, I was just sort of paralyzed. And as those of you who are regular podcast listeners know, I was sort of diving into comfort reads. I mean, I reread all of Laurie Colwin's novels, and I read James Herriot's memoirs. And I just couldn't stand the thought of anything that was going to scare me or make me cry or make me unhappy in any way, basically. But I suddenly seem to be past that. And I've got three books going right now, one of which I really hope to talk about in a future week on the podcast, which is called How to Behave Badly in Elizabethan England. But Read Me by Leo Benedictus is the kind of book that I haven't been able to pick up in a long time. And it's deeply, deeply creepy and deeply frightening. I'm the kind of person who likes a good scary book. Don't show me a slasher movie. I have no desire to see one of those. But this is a truly frightening book about a man who likes to stalk women. And I want to just read you from the first chapter because this is what hooked me. Try it yourself. That's another thing I'm saying. Go out, pick somebody and watch them. Take your phone and a notebook. Persist. You've probably already tried mildly. What begins as a confluence of yours and another person's journeys, on the train maybe, or leaving a cinema, gets into an entanglement. You follow, feeling that it's not really following because you're going the same way. And then, when they at last reach their office, you feel the clutch of a goodbye. It's normal. How many times do you think the person being followed has been you? This really creeped me out. One of the things that makes it such a creepy book is the, quote, writer of the book, the narrator, obviously a sociopath, is so smart and so charming. I will tell you something that I actually called my 20-something daughters in the middle of this book and asked if they would add me to, like, the Find Your Friends, you know, iPhone app, to which they were both like, Mom, why do you want to do that? I'm like, because I'm reading this really scary book. They were like, okay, no.
Yeah, they're like, a scary novel is not a good enough reason to do that.
Right. So it's hard to talk about exactly what happens as he follows one particular woman, which is the focus of the book. But suffice it to say that he's slowly plucking apart all the different strands of her life and ruining it, basically, ruining her career, making her live in fear. It's really a creepy book.
So you're not quite finished.
I'm a few pages from the end.
Because I was going to ask if there is a sort of, like, is there a mysterious element to it, or is it more just like a chilling psychological?
It's a chilling psychological portrait in the head of a stalker.
Is it newish?
It's a few years old, and we did review it, I believe. I think it's 2 years old. Deeply distressing.
Wow, you really have gone past the comfort reads.
I really have gone far past comfort reads at this point.
Pamela, are you reading something comforting?
You know, I'm going to bring us right back to somewhat comforting. I'm going to talk about three books that I read that are pure, fun, escapist novels. Each of these I read in the course of a weekend sitting by the fireplace. And they're all what I guess we would say are kind of genre, somewhat commercial books, but I thought all were really, really good. And maybe I shouldn't even put a but in there, because I think we all here know that commercial books are often, and genre books, really well written. That said, I often resist them, especially if they become very popular. And so one writer I've had zero desire to read is Leon Moriarty, who is probably best known for Big Little Lies. But I had a copy of one of her books, Nine Perfect Strangers. It's her most recent book. She has a book coming out this fall, sitting around. And sometimes I just kind of want to know, well, this person is so popular. Why? You know, what makes it so successful? And I also, you know, I confess, just wanted to read something fun. So I picked it up, and I have to say, she is a great writer. She's a great writer. I discussed this book with our colleague, Elizabeth Egan, who is a Leon Moriarty completist. And she said this was not the book to start with, but, you know, it was the one I had. So
too late.
And I just want to read you like one paragraph to show you what Leon Moriarty does so well is she's just incredibly observant about people. And so this novel is about a group of nine people who head to a kind of 10-day retreat where you are indulged and deprived at the same time. And it's a rotating narrative among the attendees and the people who run the retreat. So this is quoting one of the men at the retreat, Tony. They're asked to go around a room and describe why they've come to this retreat. I just want to get healthier and fitter, said Tony. Drop some weight. Men often used that phrase, drop some weight. They said it without shame or emotion, as if the weight were an object they could easily put down when they chose. Women said they needed to lose weight with their eyes down, as if the extra weight was part of them, a terrible sin they'd committed. So it's just these little things like that, that is just like better written than they need to be. And it was a total pleasure. And since I've been told that this is not her best book, now I'm kind of curious to read her best book. The other book that actually Elizabeth Egan did get me interested in reading as well is a thriller by Romy Hausman called Dear Child. We talked about it on the podcast last year when it was one of her picks for group text. And this is a German novel that's been translated. The translation from the German is by Jamie Bullock. And it was a huge international bestseller. I don't know that it hit the list here in the US. It may have, but what interested me was the fact that it was a European bestseller. And I sometimes just like to know what's selling over there. And the few things, not many, you know, that come in translation here, particularly commercial fiction, doesn't often get translated in the US, I think. Tina, am I right on that?
I don't know if you're entirely right. Certainly crime fiction is translated.
From Scandinavia, for sure.
Right.
But the fact that this was German interested me especially because this is, it's kind of, you know, Room meets Gone Girl is the elevator pitch. And we think about these sort of horrific kidnappings and entrapment of women as an American phenomenon. But of course, there have been some very famous cases of this in Germany as well. And so that aspect sort of interested me, how this might be particularly German in some way versus how it might be American. But it really held me to the very end. And that description is just spot on. I don't want to say anything more about it in case you want to read it. And then the third book that I just read this past weekend was for my children's literature book club, which I've been really negligent with. I have not been to a meeting since early pandemic. But I read Winter Keep by Kristen Kishore, which is part of a group of novels that she's written. These are young adult novels that are part of what's called the Graceling Realm. And she's just so good. She's been on the podcast before for a standalone novel she did called Jane Unlimited. Here she returns to the Graceling Realm. She's written three books about this world, starting with Graceling. And I just highly recommend them. This one, my daughter read first, and I always like to read YA through a kind of double lens of just reading it for myself, but also reading it, knowing that mostly teenagers are reading it and kind of thinking about what is this saying to them? How are they seeing this? One thing that's interesting is that there's so many characters that at the beginning of this novel and many high fantasy novels, I'm often very lost. I'm like, I do not understand this world. I don't know where we are. I read the last one 3 years ago. I cannot remember. And there are many, many characters. And then I realized, of course, that's the way teenagers operate now. You know, their many worlds are on social media and they have a million connections. And so they're, you know, quite accustomed to keeping track of like probably more people at a time than I am. And so I don't think they struggle sort of getting hold of things the way I did.
I guess there's a reason they call like all those movies and series of books now universes, which is yes. Sounds so intimidating.
Well, you know, the Marvel Universe is also quite popular, right? In my household, not surprisingly. But Kristen Kishore is really smart. These books are so well done. I don't want to reveal any plot points. I don't know how many people I will persuade to pick up this, but Graceling was one of the first YA novels I read as an adult, right after I joined my Kidlit book club at the urging of fellow members, and it really delivers. So I would say that if you're interested at all in sort of trying, it was also the first high fantasy novel I'd read. If you're interested in just trying out fantasy or trying YA, I recommend starting with Kristen Kishore. So that's it. John, let's go through the titles again. What did you read?
I'm reading right now Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy by John le Carré.
And I'm reading Read Me by Leo Benedictus.
And I read three books, Leon Moriarty's Nine Perfect Strangers, Dear Child by Romy Hausman, and Winter Keep by Kristen Kishore. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.